You are listening to the Sarah Fader podcast, and I'm Sarah Fader, I believe. This is what anxiety feels like. I'm here with my homegirl, Dr. April Forman. She is a psychologist who specializes in borderline personality disorder. She has a passion for the veterans, and she actually helps with suicide prevention, specifically with veterans. And she's just an all-around amazing person. How are you doing?
Oh, Sarah, so first of all, I'm so excited to be on your podcast, and I'm kind of excited to finally, talk to your face and, be here in person, because we have known each other, through the social medias for a little while, and so I always love it when you find people that you sort of agree with, and then you get to, do a project. So I am so excited to be here and to speak with the people in your network. How is everybody doing today?
How are y'all doing? And you know what? I think the coolest thing about you, which is why I was drawn to you in the first place, is that all of your social media pictures are you with a ridiculous nose and mustache. Can you tell us why? Is that for confidentiality or what's the deal?
I know that's what people say, because, shrinks are, really frightened of being seen, and I that's pretty, weird. First of all, if you see a shrink, it's I don't want to be recognized. That's you're not James Franco.
Get over yourself, right?
right. So I used to have, a professional headshot, and everybody who knows me or sees me speak said, it's I'm in a suit, and I look so professional, which I do, I could totally clean up well. But they were that is really uptight, and that's not your personality. And one day I was just in my office, and I happened to have lots of funny props, this is just a thing. Mm-hmm. And I had these funny Groucho glasses, and I took a picture and Instagrammed myself wearing them, and I just put it up, and it got such great response. People just loved it, and they're that's who you are. And so I just put that up as my social media avatar, and, it's really recognizable, and I'll wear Groucho glasses when I speak or whatever, and people think it's fun. And then, then years later, then they're like, maybe that's because she's a psychologist and she's afraid of being recognized. I was a psychologist practicing in a rural town of only 8,000 people. My husband was an assistant principal at the school. And, had, the largest elementary school in the state of Kansas. And so, I would go pick up my son from kindergarten, and the teachers and the parents and the kids there might be my patients, my husband employees, my son's schoolmates, whatever. And I might be going to buy, tampons at the grocery store. My patient might be there doing the same. But I'm not very worried about that, because almost anything when it comes to being a mental health professional and to be interested in helping folks with borderline personality disorder, there is a certain acceptance that you're going to be seen and that it's going to be okay.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that it wasn't you being incognito. It was just you being ridiculous.
I have a yodeling pickle.
That's so awesome. Fun. What sign are you, by the way?
I'm a Leo.
Oh, you're totally a Leo. Come on, the Groucho glasses.
How about you?
I'm a Libra. But, I have the scales, right? But the thing is, I'm actually kind of, I'm a fake Libra. I know, nobody can see it, but we know. So the thing is, I'm kind of a fake Libra because I have so much Scorpio in my chart. So I'm all emotional and brooding, very emo,
I don't know. Then my son must be a Scorpio. He's turned 14 and we've hit that. I don't know.
A 14-year-old? That's insanity. Wait, hold on. When is his birthday? What sign is he?
He's a Cancer.
Aww.
And the daughter is a Virgo, and we've had all the fun with this. There's this great fountain in Kansas City at the Nelson that has the zodiac around, and my kids and I, we go take pictures and have a great time.
I love it.
Yeah.
So tell me about, first of all, for people that don't know, what is borderline personality disorder?
Oh, I wish that there was just one definition that was out there, and people really don't like the name. So here's what I've learned about all of mental health. If there is something that we're not comfortable with, if there's something that's stigmatized and that we can't just accept and we're not relaxed with, we just keep renaming it. And borderline personality disorder, because people just aren't comfortable with it, they just want to keep renaming it. I don't really care if we call it purple zebra disorder. I don't care at all. And I understand that there, language does matter. And I think I even worked with Sean Erger to write a thing about language matters and borderline personality disorder. But what happens is that the name starts being attached to the stigma.
Sure.
But the basic thing you need to know is that there are folks who through a combination of genetic sensitivity to mood dysregulation. So you might have a sensitivity to mood or anxiety disorders to begin with, and varying degrees of biological sensitivity. Then experience what's called an invalidating environment. So some point in their childhood, either the environment is very traumatic and abusive and invalidating, like much more so than average, and so their understandable reactions to a very bad environment aren't validated. Nobody tells them how to behave or how to deal with their pain or their moods. Or you have these mood fluctuations and a normal environment doesn't understand them and can't tell you what to do. But there's sort of this mismatch. And so you don't learn, you don't appropriately at this developmental stage sort of learn how to understand what's happening with you internally and how to regulate it and how to sort of how to interact with others like really effectively. And so as a result, as you age, as you start to get to end of adolescence, early adulthood, you might have things like, you know, mood that really, really shifts every 2 to 4 hours that you don't understand and don't manage very well. You might have people who abandon you because your mood is so painful for people around you. You may be people like you because when you're in a good mood, you're probably really cool to hang out with. And then your mood might shift. And for folks who don't have that going on, that's like, and even for folks who do, like, that's painful and hard to deal with. And so you might get rejected and mistreated a lot, and you might become very sensitive to that. You may have really chaotic, intense, stormy relationships. You may have some things like called black and white thinking, where like you tend to think things all like one extreme or all another extreme, and very, very hard to sort of see things or behave in a middle path kind of way, or to have sort of nuanced views of things. You may have such intense emotional pain that you might self-harm. You might attempt suicide. You might use alcohol or other drugs. Or you might use sex, or you might use things like spending or dangerous behavior to sort of manage your mood. You may have difficulty concentrating. So especially a lot of my folks who have borderline personality disorder in men, when they get stressed or overwhelmed, which happens like a couple times a day, they develop this like really intense sort of cognitive fogginess. They get sort of dissociative. They feel kind of spacey and out of it. It's a weird coping mechanism. And you might even have sort of quick flights of temper. And it's just like, it's really painful. As a matter of fact, Marshall Linehan said, having borderline personality disorder is like being an emotional burn victim. So imagine when you have a burn on your skin. I feel this, like, I wish people were in video, but like, imagine you gently touching a sunburn and it hurts. A little bit of joy hurts, a little bit of sadness hurts, and there is no such thing as a little bit of everything. It's like your nerve endings, your emotional nerve endings, and your ability to manage that is just not well regulated. How did I do?
That was like an A++.
No.
So I've heard this before where even if you don't have, you know, classic borderline, that some of us have borderline traits.
Yeah, but you know, they say that about all, so there's like in the DSM, there are like sort of 10 personality disorders,
right?
And there's sort of 3 clusters.
Sure.
And cluster B, which is my favorite, borderline personality disorders in there, along with antisocial personality disorder, which doesn't mean that you're shy. It means that you're a sociopath.
Yeah.
Personality disorder and histrionic personality disorder. And with all of those sort of cluster B, what you have is that there's an important sort of function in your way of being that would normally help you socially or interpersonally regulate, and that it's sort of missing. And so with borderline personality disorder, it's sort of this sort of mood thermostat, this sort of thing that helps you sort of regulate your emotional pain and your way of being so that it's homeostatic, right? So you're really consistent with the other disorders, it's other things. And when we look at these, you could have borderline personality disorder where you could really have that dysregulation like in spades, or you could have like my thermostat at my house, which does regulate a little bit, but it's not terribly precise. And the facts are, when we're talking about like psychology and mental health,
right,
what we're interested in is not, we're not interested in labeling you like we're grading diamonds, right? And I'm selling, like, where I have to make a precise calculation of what category you're in so that I can categorize you. We're really just interested in how effective are you in your day-to-day life? Like, can you make and keep important relationships? Can you work? Can you be a good daughter, a good sister, a good mother, a good partner, or husband, obviously? You know, they're not just female pronouns. you know, like, what is your emotional pain like? Like, right. Do you wake up and are you super functional, but inside you're suffering all the time? And so, you know, we sort of look at those sorts of things. So I'm interested in helping people who are suffering, and I don't really need for you to have borderline personality disorder. And I love this sort of Spinal Tap at an 11, right? With the dial all the way turned up. If you came to me and you were very, very functional, and your symptoms weren't very obvious, you only had a few, but they were really hurting you. Well, a lot of the ways that we might help you, like, they're the same techniques. So of course we would want to help folks, even if they were, and the term for that is subclinical,
right?
Like, even if you had much smaller version of that, right?
Right.
Does that help?
Yeah, totally. I think that, so what is it about treating people with BPD that you enjoy personally?
You know, I'm going to tell you, I didn't start out that way.
Mm-hmm.
My very, very, very first client ever had borderline personality disorder, and I was working in a student clinic, and we didn't have enough patient census at that time, and I really need to get some training. And so, like, it was not ideal to have a beginning therapist, like, for that to be their very first person that they saw. And it didn't go well, because this is not, you should never start with a highly complex treatment with a beginning student. And also, there wasn't anybody in the clinic who was really well trained in that. And so predictably there were problems, and I learned, and I thought, I never want to do this again. Prior to that experience, I was an RA at a university, and, you know, we had a young woman on the floor that I was responsible for, and I don't know if she had borderline personality disorder. I was not her clinician, but my experience living with this person was a pretty close fit, and that was also pretty painful. And so I didn't come from a place of compassion, like, where I just sort of naturally thought this was great. What happened was, I left academe and I go to rural Kansas, and there are these patients who have this disorder. And I know from my training, even though this is not an area that initially at all I wanted to even touch or go near, because it has such a bad reputation, right? And I'd had some painful experiences. But ultimately, I started looking at the books, and there were folks who had this disorder. There was nobody who had the training or desire to help them get well. We were totally willing to give them high-frequency treatments and bill like crazy, so, like, and have them not get well. And you know, I was looking at patients where we were billing hundreds of thousands of dollars for years and years and years for them to not be any better and maybe even be worse. And there's a part of me that is not about empathy. There's a part of me that's just sort of about social justice. And it's like, you know, sometimes not always my finest hour, like maybe I can be a little self-righteous, but, I mean, if I'm being honest.
No, but I get it. But you know what? It's fun,
yeah,
because
it's
like
okay.
sometimes I enjoy standing on a soapbox. You know, I find that really fun.
So I climbed right up there.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, damn it, this is not right. And so I was like, well, who will do something about this? And I was like, why can't we just refer them to DBT? And of course, everyone's just laughing at me.
Right.
And also, what was really, really painful was, you know, the what happens with borderline personality disorder, if your staff's not properly trained, they get burned out, like, because it's not easy to do. And if you aren't trained, it's not really, well, it's not good for your health to do until you have the training to sort of be well while doing it. And so, of course, staff got very passive aggressive, and things that should not happen really commonly. And all of this just caused me intense moral outrage. And I was not happy at work. And so I get this job coach, and I'm sort of griping about it. And
yes.
She's like, well, then you're just going to get DBT training, and you're just going to open a DBT clinic and do it then if you're going to complain. And this was horrible, because it's super expensive and hard to do. And I didn't know even how to get started, and I was in the middle of nowhere. And this is where Twitter and social media comes in, because I was just starting to use it, and I was working with Tony Wood, who's my collaborator on many projects. And my coach says, you're going to work with this IT guy, you're going to use social media magically to meet Marshall Linehan, and you're going to get some DBT training, and you're going to open a clinic, and you're going to help people. And that's exactly, by the way, over the course of a couple of years, exactly what happened. Well, once I got the training,
mm-hmm.
and I saw that these people could recover, and they could be helped, and that they were not the borderlines who we're just going to bill a lot of money and put up with them, but they were just real people who could become asymptomatic and, like, not have the disorder anymore. And you could do that at a high rate. So that wasn't the exception. The research was really clear that 70 or 80% of the time, that was the expected outcome. I was like, well, I can make a difference. These people are really hurting, and I could help instead of being scared or hurt.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know so much about DBT other than the fact that it is used to treat borderline. But I've also heard that it's used for different disorders besides borderline.
Yes.
Right?
Totally.
Like somebody, so my friend who has bipolar type 2, which I also have, said that it is effectively used for bipolar disorder as well.
It totally can be because it's, remember, these are skills about relationships and emotional regulation and distress tolerance. And for folks who have substance use disorders and things like that. And more specifically, because it's not about the diagnosis. DBT is a treatment for people who have been failed by other treatments.
Right.
And so when I think of these folks that I was really seeing, these were people who had already showed up. So first of all, had taken the brave step of coming into the clinic and asking for help and getting insurance and filling out paperwork and everything. It's so hard to even get mental health care. And then they had gone through it, and then they got blamed for the treatment not working. You would never in any other healthcare session or like whatever blame the patient for the therapy not being effective.
That's really that's fucked up.
Right. So DBT is really for folks who've been through the other therapies and the other therapies didn't work.
Right.
And so it's not even for all folks with borderline personality disorder. Some folks with that, like, they get some Rogerian listening and they sort it out. Like, it's for the folks that have been failed by other treatments. And so for me, that's who I'm interested in helping. I'm interested in who's already done everything else.
And right? So let's try DBT with you. What is the difference between CBT and DBT?
Excellent point. So first of all, there are elements of cognitive behavioral therapy in DBT, but DBT has like some extra pieces. So the first thing is, you're dealing with folks who have a higher risk for death by suicide. So it's the highest mortality rate disorder you can pretty much have. So 3 to 10% of folks with borderline personality disorder die by suicide. If I showed up at my doctor with a condition, and my primary care doctor, and I knew that 3 to 10% of the time that my doctor diagnosed me with this would kill me, everyone would take that just so seriously, right?
Yes.
So I take that very, very seriously. So we think about suicide and life-threatening behavior a lot. So like with CBT, maybe that's in the mix, and there is CBT brief interventions for suicidality. But with DBT, like number one, like I'm not interested in your history of trauma. I'm really not. Like, or I might be interested in your history of trauma incidentally as it sort of relates. But mostly I'm interested in keeping you alive and helping you with all the things that might get in the way of you dying because you have a really high risk of that happening. And then the second thing I'm going to be interested in is what's called therapy interference. Mm-hmm. And do folks on your podcast talk about that a lot?
What can you define what that is?
I would love to, Sarah, because this is something that the patients get blamed for, and I know I use words like patient because I work in a medical center, and I know that there is real sensitivity about language. So you might say client, or you might say consumer, or whatever.
But here's the thing: before you even get into that, my pet peeve is like fucking language policing.
So, fantastic.
You know what I mean? So like, I can't stand it when someone's like, "Don't say that." Because, you know what, unless it's derogatory or offensive, that's a different story. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and everyone knows, like, my folks that I work with, they know what I care about.
Yeah.
Because I care about people getting better and not suffering. But anyway.
Yes.
And that's bottom line. So therapy interference is anything that gets in the way of therapy working.
Right.
So therapy interference can be something on the part of the client or the patient, right? It can be they don't come to appointments. Or they're using, and so they come to appointments under the influence. Or they come to appointments, and then instead of any time that there's something hard to work on, they verbally abuse you and scream at you and slam the door and walk out. And then, of course, by the way, call me back 30 minutes later. It's sweet. It could be filing complaints about the therapist. So for several of my patients that I've worked with, they have a long history of filing complaints, like really serious ones. So people don't want to work with them anymore because they're trying to stand up for themselves. So like it's a functional thing that they're having emotions and they're trying to stand up for themselves, but it just doesn't go very well.
Right.
It also could be something that the therapist is doing. So by the way, when we do DBT, me and my peeps, like therapy interference could be my part. So it could be if I'm really sensitive to something. So every time we, you know, I'm thinking of one of my patients who just had, a particular lifestyle. And I don't mean, but I don't mean sexual orientation by that. I really do mean a particular lifestyle,
right?
That I'm not entirely comfortable with.
Okay.
Like, I'm not judgmental about it, but it makes me a little squeamish.
So would that be countertransference?
No. Like, okay. This isn't, like, about anything about me I'm projecting onto.
Okay.
The thing that's important to them and how they want to live is something that literally, physically makes me squeamish.
Like, it makes you ill.
Right. And if I avoid talking about important things that need to be talked about or addressing things that need to be addressed because I'm a little bit uncomfortable, or if I judge it, and in fact, I didn't do any of that. I got consultation so that I understood it well. And of course, at the end of our therapy relationship, the conversation was, I would watch you turn green all the time. And I'm like, I know, this was a really hard for me. So if I avoided topics, like that would be therapy interference. Another thing could be therapy interference, like in terms of the system. So if you and the person at the front desk don't get along and they actively forget to schedule your appointments, or what if our computer interface is bad and it loses your appointments or doesn't remind you like it's supposed to? Or therapy interference could be the public transportation system is unreliable and doesn't come on time. There could be all sorts of things that get in the way of you benefiting from therapy. Therapy interference could be the therapy room is not in the best location and it makes it very, very hard to do the work you need to do. Therapy interference could be anything. And so that's one of the things. Like, this is like usually session one or two, this is what we talk about. So with DBT, we're going to look at suicidal and life-threatening behavior immediately. Like, we don't talk about anything unless I can keep you alive because nothing else will work. Like, I can't help you with your emotional pain if you die. So we focus on the life we're living and how we stay alive. Then we start resolving all the things that keep you from getting well. Like, I had a patient I just love. Well, I love my patients. That's another great thing about DBT is like there's really, really comfort with therapists saying how much they love the people that they work with.
Well, I feel like I feel like in order to do this work, you have to love it, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't love the work. I love my patients.
Okay.
And the therapy, like, I was so grateful when I finally got supervision in this modality. And like, of course you love your patients. You're making a lot of sacrifices to go above and beyond for them. You get to know them in a very, very personal way. And you have to love them to hang with them sometimes when it's very painful. And
right. So you were saying that you had one patient.
Anyway, I just loved her. Mm-hmm. And in order to get her to come to therapy and to benefit and get well, and someone was asking me to do a case study on therapy interference. And I thought, we've overcome so many. I went through and I think I identified, I was just brainstorming in 10 minutes, 14 therapy interference issues that we had to solve. And so for folks with borderline personality disorder, there's stuff that they're doing in their way of being often that gets in the way of therapy. But also there's just, they've lived from crisis to crisis because they're not functioning well. So usually things like not having consistent income to put gas in the car, not being able to get up on time and not to keep a routine schedule. And clinics really demanding that I have a routine schedule, not having the appropriate money for the appropriate clothes to wear to the clinic. Maybe the public school closes or they have a kid who has got discipline problems all the time and that cancels a bunch of sessions. Like, I mean, it could be a gazillion things. You have to solve all of those things. And then with DBT, like, then we talk about skill set. And so with CBT, we're going to talk about your emotions, your behavior, and your thoughts, and we're going to think about what's pain, what's hurting you, and adjust how you emotionally respond, adjust how you think about it, adjust how you act to sort of get where you're going. With borderline personality disorder, you were definitely doing some of those things, but you're adding four really specific. So first of all, you're triaging things in that order, and you're adding four specific skill sets. There's mindfulness because DBT has a real basis in Zen Buddhism, so you're really working on mindfulness, and that's because folks with borderline personality disorder often have impairments in what's called executive functioning, which is a certain part of your brain that regulates things. And the sort of the mindfulness practices of Zen Buddhism actually improve how that part of your brain functions. And that's like the only way to do that. So We're improving your biological capability of doing things you couldn't do before. Then we're helping you tolerate pain without making life worse. So that's distress tolerance. We're helping you regulate your emotions. And then there's this huge piece of getting your needs met with other people, through other people. And so folks with borderline personality disorder get called manipulative. And I think that's such a joke. If you're actually manipulative, then people do what you want and they like it.
Right.
You're only manipulative if you try to get people to help you and then they don't. Because all of us need people to get anything done. Right?
Yeah.
Like we all meet our needs largely through others in all sorts of ways. So with borderline personality disorder, what we're hoping for is to teach you how to do that, and people are into it.
Right.
I'm like, you're not actually manipulative, but I'm going to make you manipulative, and we're going to really learn
right,
how
like
to do it.
Right, constructively and productively manipulative.
Effective, yeah. And that's another word. So in DBT, we're not interested in right or wrong or good or bad, or maybe we are sort of in a sense about what your internal values are. What we're interested in is the big E word, which is effective, which is what you do gets you what you want. And so for all of the folks I work with, and I don't know that this is standard across folks, but it's pretty common. I ask them to identify a goal, and the goal is not to be the best mental health patient ever and to control your symptoms, which is totally what insurers reimburse for. The goal is like, what do you want? So do you want to own your own home? Maybe you want to be married and have a partner that you love in a healthy relationship, or have kids. Maybe you want a job that you really like. Maybe you want like friends that you look forward to hanging out with and who don't quit you. You know, maybe you want to make more money. Maybe you want to start a business. Like I can think of like, so my folks identify a goal and I encourage it to be something you actually want, not a symptom goal. And then everything that we do is about getting you the life that you want. Because also, so here's also sort of the catch. If you have borderline personality disorder, even if you recover and we reduce your symptoms so you don't qualify for that disorder anymore, which I've seen happen many times.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Like, years of therapy, but totally have seen it happen.
Actually, you know what? That is, I do know one person that I've met through a mental health advocacy that told me that that has happened for her.
I totally had folks for whom that this was the case, and then they just weren't having those symptoms anymore.
So that's possible. Now, so full recovery from having BPD is possible.
Totally possible. Now, the thing is, remember, you're going to have that genetic mood sensitivity, so you may still have, like, a bipolar 2 disorder.
Right.
Or you may have an anxiety disorder. Like, you're probably still going to have that original mood disorder. So borderline personality disorder is a sort of, it's like a complication. It's like you start with a simple infection that doesn't heal like it should, and the environment interacts, and then you develop this secondary problem. And we heal the secondary problem, but you go on treating that sort of underlying condition, maybe chronically, for the rest of your life. So no one who's recovered from the borderline personality disorder I've ever known 100% gets rid of the underlying mood or anxiety disorder.
Right.
But they don't have a personality disorder anymore, which I think is awesome, and they're still them. That's another real fear, is that if you go to DBT, I'll get rid of what's cool and different and weird and neat about you. And I won't. Like, you're still going to be you, mm-hmm. but you're going to be you having the life you want and in less pain.
Okay, so I feel like you've sold DBT, and now I want to do DBT.
Let me tell you, the DBT skill set, like I have two kids who are 11 and 14.
Right.
And they don't know what DBT is from a hole in the wall, but they use a lot of that language because I use all the skills.
Sure.
So all the things, yeah, like I do all the practices that I'm teaching patients to do, and it's just good for you.
For
so.
Sure. So my question about DBT, though, for some reason, and I don't know whether this is accurate or not, but I've always associated DBT with group therapy.
You know, that was a great question. Sarah, you're the best interviewer.
Oh, you're the best in general.
So DBT has a couple components. So there is a skills group, which is like a class, right? It's like
right.
group study.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on learning the skills. And I love skills groups. So this is probably some therapist's personal nightmare, which is a room full of folks with borderline personality disorder who apply to every other therapist in the clinic.
Right.
So for years and years and years, that is my room. And by the way, it is almost always my favorite time of the week whenever the group is scheduled. And I always come home in a really good mood. Only every once in a while has it been a really rough group. Most of the time, it's phenomenal. And because it's like didactic, right? It's school, it's thought, it's fun. People are really invested. We really structure the environment so you're less likely to be dysregulated. So there's a whole bunch of things that go into skills group that make it really safe for folks with borderline personality disorder and that make it pleasant most of the time, even if the topic is sort of hard. With folks with borderline personality disorder often don't generalize skills, so they may have the skill in this little area of their life, and they don't see my hands, but they may not have it in this other area of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that is trying to help them identify when they've used that skill and how to produce it at will in a concrete step 1, 2, 3 recipe box kind of way. And it's teaching, and I love teaching. Then the other piece is individual therapy.
Right.
So that's where we're going to find out we're going to address suicidal thoughts and feelings. We're going to really address individual therapy interference. And then we're going to work on your goals and you one-on-one, what happened? How can I help? And sort of helping you work through that. And I always tell my folks, if you want to talk about your long history of trauma, which, by the way, I don't ever get anybody in group that doesn't have a really horrible history of trauma. It's just, I'm not interested until you are not feeling like you want to kill yourself or trying to kill yourself or harm yourself, not getting in the way of treatment, and you understand and can use some skills. Then we can talk about your trauma history. But talking about the past is way down on the triage list. Because it was just too much to do. And then in between individual sessions, because Sarah, I bet you this, you identify with this.
Yes.
I know I identify with this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need therapy at a scheduled time. You usually need the advice when stuff's going like sideways. So there's something called coaching calls. I'm totally mimicking like a phone.
You can't see it, but April's on a pretend hand phone right now.
Right.
Yes.
Like an old, like phones that don't even exist anymore, which is silly. So
I do miss a good landline. I'm going to just put that out there.
But you can call in for these, and I keep them really 10 or 20 minutes. They're not long calls because I think when you know what you're doing, very rarely do you need a long coaching call.
No.
And so someone's calling, they're dysregulated, and when you're dysregulated, it's hard to think clearly or strategically, and the goal is to help you get mindful very quickly, identify what's going on, decide on a skill to use, and try it, and then call for, like, if you still need help. And so my folks, when I'm working VA, and I'm not speaking officially as someone who works for Veterans Affairs, but I do work there, and I can talk about my work. But, like, one of the things that I do is we have the Veterans Crisis Line, and they're really, really good.
Right.
And so, like, if they need to call in the middle of the night, they can call there, and I would get an alert the next morning and call. But if it's during business hours, I give them my direct phone. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. Now, sometimes I'm talking with someone else in crisis, so, like, I got to finish that up. But I'll call you back pretty quick, and we'll go over what happened. And I'll say, okay, so what's going on? And then you'll have something to fix it right then. Because I think people... Like, I know my kids learn really, really well right in that moment.
Yeah,
like,
I think right that's really, that's excellent because I find that, especially for me, right, having anxiety, like having panic disorder, sometimes it's like in the middle of having an episode of panic, you don't want to wait until your therapy session to fix what's going on, you know?
Right. Panic is horrible.
Terrible.
It's terrible. And, like, you can't think clearly. So that's a perfect moment for someone who can think clearly to sort of provide some structure, help you sort of snap back to it, like, get back in control of your awareness, and then, like, walk through what you need to do. And you can learn, right? So the brain that you're in when you panic, it's called state-dependent learning, is not the brain that's in the therapist's office by appointment.
Right. You know what? You're going to laugh at this, but the other day I had a situation. I ran into my first boyfriend ever, okay, in Seattle, right? And it was the weirdest situation ever. And, like, I totally started to have severe panic because I was like, this is so fucking strange. You know, like, I couldn't process it. So you know how I love Twitter. Twitter and I are, like, BFFs. Yeah, exactly. All the thumbs.
I'm making hand motions. Sorry.
You're, like, knitting with your thumbs. So I tweeted out. I was like, hey, whoever on here has my phone number, please text me right now because I'm having a panic attack. And, like, within 20 seconds, I had people that were, like, had my back, you know? Because the thing is, my brain was so fucked up in that moment, like, I couldn't think who to text or who to talk to. I was like, what the fuck?
But it wasn't so fucked up you couldn't problem solve at all.
Right, exactly. But it's funny because one of my really good friends texted me and he was like, what's happening? You know, let's talk through this. And that's the thing about, that is, like, the good part of social media is that, you know, it does kind of have this kind of unifying, you know,
totally.
Community, you know, and there's totally. There is no shame. This is what I tell people. My pet peeve is, like, don't discourage people from reaching out for help on social media, because if that's their community, right? It's just as valid to say text your best friend as it is to reach out for your online friends.
Totally. And so, you know, and I would sort of add one piece to that, which is, as long as the way that you're doing it doesn't cost you friends on social media. So if you're doing it and people stay your friends and they help you and you're sort of calling in crisis less and less often and people feel closer to you and better about helping you, like, then that's exactly what you want. And if you are reaching out on social media and as a result, people begin to feel overwhelmed by your pain, don't feel adequate to help you, you find that you're getting rejected sometimes, then maybe, I'm not saying do or don't do it. I'm saying, like, what you do and how you do it, as long as you get better in the moment and, like, your long-term game in terms of relationships and in terms of stability are met, then I say, like, do it. Because remember, for me, it's that E word, that effectiveness. Like, you should do the things that work.
Yep, exactly. So this is an interesting question from a therapist's point of view. I've got to charge my laptop because it's like, I'm dying. I'm sad. So my question is, and I think that this could be like a BPD thing or just like a person thing, which is that people, and I mean, I know I have this issue, but like the sensitivity to getting unfriended or on Facebook.
Right, because social media there could be a lot of rejection, right?
Sure.
And it hurts everybody, right?
It does. And to me, and so like I personally find that challenging. You know, like,
yeah.
I do. I find it challenging because what it does for anxiety is it's like, oh, well, what the fuck? Like, what did I do? Did I offend that person? Or, like, to me, it's like it goes down this path of, like, and then I don't know. Like, what's the coping mechanism for that?
So I would say that I don't know that there's one coping mechanism, and I don't know that there's one way to think about it. So, like, There is certainly a popular wisdom in, like, you know, forget them. If they don't like you, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But if you're getting unfriended a bunch, then you might be doing some things that aren't very effective and aren't helping you with your goals. So in my mind, if you noticed you were getting unfriended or unfollowed by folks and it was happening, like, more than once, or it was happening in a really important relationship, like, that's a time for you to do, you know, in DBT we call that a chain link analysis, for you to sort of think, like, what's happened.
Right.
But if generally speaking, the people who care about you still care about you, you don't really have, you know, some people unfriend you, but other people are fine. Someone's unfriended you, that relationship, I mean, sometimes you have to think, like, how important is this relationship to me or these
Definitely.
Relationships? And if they're very important, then you should take action.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And use your relationship repair skills. But sometimes it's just not that important. Like, if you were to unfriend me, it would bug me. So I might, like, say, like, dude, I noticed you unfriend me. If I did something wrong, I'd love to talk about it, even if we never become friends again, because clearly I need to grow as a human being.
Yeah, I actually did that one time. Someone unfriended me, and I was like, hey, I just wanted to check in and see if there was something I did to hurt your feelings. And it was a good conversation. You know, it actually was productive. But yeah, uh-huh. I do find, see, I think, and I mean, I don't know, you can probably speak to this from a therapist's point of view, that there is a little bit of overlap between bipolar and borderline.
Right. So remember that you have to have this initial problem with mood and
right.
anxiety.
Yeah, exactly.
And bipolar disorders are actually pretty rare, so they're largely genetic. They aren't very common. And they involve mood instability that sort of has, like, a sine wave, and it's not very externally caused.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there may be things in your environment or taking your medication or not that make it better or worse, but generally speaking, you're going to have, like, these little periods of mania or hypermania, and I'm sort of drawing a sine wave, and then you're going to have these longer periods of normal mood and then depression, and it's going to go just like a little sine wave, up and down like a curve. And even if you and folks with bipolar disorders only often have great interpersonal relationships, so they don't have, it's not, their mood isn't shifting every 2 to 4 hours. Like if someone tells you you have rapid cycling bipolar disorder, that's so incredibly rare. You probably have borderline personality disorder. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I know.
Like,
you know,
what? Rapid cycling bipolar. I'm like, no, honey, if your mood every single day changes every 2 to 4 hours and you're largely changes by something that quote unquote triggered you in your environment.
Right.
Go have, at least go get borderline personality disorder ruled out by a professional.
Right.
Because bipolar, it's controlled by medication. There's no other really good way to control it, but by medication and good self-care. You don't have the same interpersonal problems. When you aren't manic, you're sort of manic for a couple of days, you're depressed for a couple of months, like, and they're sort of, those moods are long states. With borderline personality disorder, you're having brief and intense reactions to stimulation in your environment. Your mood shifts every 2 to 4 hours. And you have all these other interpersonal symptoms and self-harm and you can have both. It's not super common, but bipolar disorders actually aren't super common.
Yeah, they're not. It's this is kind of fucked up, but so my friend is a social worker. She's an MSW, and this is one of my best friends. And I always say to her, because, you know, like you get paranoid when you read the DSM. You think you have everything. So I say to, I've said this to her multiple times. I'm like, I think I have borderline. She's like, listen, if you had borderline, we would not have this long-term relationship. We would not be friends.
Maybe. Possible. You know?
But I think, I don't know. I sometimes wonder, but I feel like, again, it's like one of those things when you read the DSM, you just think that you do.
So the question I always have is, like, so the label and the diagnosis is pretty important when it comes to treatment planning.
Right.
But like if you go in and they say whatever label they give you, if mm-hmm. they give you treatment and it works, great. The time to reconsider whether or not the label is right is when you are going in for treatment and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, so to me, like, getting diagnosed with bipolar type 2 was, like, life-changing because it really was. I mean, it was the best. Like, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, I couldn't figure it out. And I was like, why do I feel euphoric and why can't I, like, function or get places on time or like, and because the thing is, I was convinced that it was my ADD, my ADHD impacting me in this way. Like, and
is your IQ also a little high?
Yeah, I actually have a genius level IQ.
Yeah, that goes, that's genetically more related to the bipolar disorders than with the, anyway, that's so cute.
Yeah.
Those are things that are sort of genetic. Way to go, yeah. Boss.
I know. I mean, I don't like to, like, brag about it, but it's true.
but that, by the way, is more common than people realize. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so my IQ is, like, crazy high. But it's also kind of offset because I have a visual spatial learning disability, so it's a little bit, you know, there's like, a weird thing happening. But yeah, so, like, once I started taking Lamictal, I was like, holy shit, like, I can actually think now. Like, everything Aww. Makes sense, and I don't feel, I felt like more like myself, you know?
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's the best feeling. And so, but I think I was resistant to, because it's like I got used to taking antidepressants, and I was like, I know what these are, I feel comfortable with them. But that's the thing about bipolar, is the paranoia is so intense that it's difficult sometimes to get the adequate treatment, you know?
If you have borderline personality disorder, Lamictal doesn't fix it. So, like, yeah. So you can have both. But the thing with borderline personality disorder is, what happens for most of the folks I see is that they've been given every medication under the sun, and they're taking a lot, or they've taken a lot of different kinds, and it never quite regulates it.
Right.
And so so with borderline personality disorder, like I said, you've got this different pattern of dysregulation.
Yeah.
And when we start getting it under control with these behavioral interventions, these skills that we're using and this mindfulness that we're using, then the Lamictal works. And so with a lot of my folks who have borderline personality disorder, they take less medications and simpler medications, sometimes at lower doses, but they suddenly work. because we've dealt with all of the with the parts of the dysregulation that were skill and behavior based.
So maybe it's like the borderline is like a MRSA infection, and then
exactly
right. It's like borderline is like MRSA, and then like once you remove MRSA, it's just staff.
I've said that. You're so brilliant. Like that's exactly it. So exactly. So. And that's one of the ways to rule out, which is if we do all the standard things for your mood, if your mood fits this pattern that's way more like borderline personality disorder, and we've given you every medication under the sun, even if you do have a bipolar disorder, and for my folks with borderline personality disorder, what usually happens is we start addressing the skills and we sort of knock off that layer of things, and that's actually when we start to diagnose the bipolar disorder. So I'm thinking of patients that I've had, and it's only been a couple, because real bipolar disorders are kind of rare statistically.
Yeah.
But then what happens is I'm no longer seeing this, but I am seeing these, and I also have patients track their mood like every day, and so that I start to see this sine wave of mood dysregulation that's not reactive. And then I go, oh, you know what? And also with folks with borderline personality disorder, they're often also using drugs and sex. So when we quit using drugs and sex and self-harm to regulate our mood, that's when the depression pattern shows up. That's when the bipolar depression pattern shows up. That's when the anxiety disorder, and then you can see the signal for those disorders very clearly. That's when suddenly it occurs to the doctor which medication's going to work, and we sort of clean it up and make it less complicated. That always takes a year or two to figure that out,
for sure. I mean, that's the other reason I was like, oh, maybe I'm BPD, because I'm, like, super hypersexual, but that's bipolar also, you know?
Well, so the issue is, are you super hypersexual every single day, every couple of hours, or only during manic periods?
Manic.
And so that's, and that's how you sort of start to tell the whole thing apart. And by the way, there are some people with just high sex drive, so the question is, if you're being sexual, but it's fine and it's life enhancing and it doesn't cause pain and suffering, but makes your life better, totally fine.
Yeah, and to me, exactly. I am a very sexual person, but it's never like, what's the word, risky or dangerous. Like, it's always like right. With one person and, you know, like a monogamous partner or whatever. It's like, it's never something like ridiculous, you know?
Totally. But for some of my folks who have borderline personality disorder, they're also, I'm just being very blunt, but yeah. So a lot of folks with BPD also are simultaneously interested in the BDSM and kink culture.
Totally, yeah.
And there are ways that are sort of sex positive and healthy ways, and that are to go about that. And there are ways that are not life affirming, not sex positive, that are just kind of disordered. And for me, that was really hard. Like I'm my personal life is not very exciting. So for me, in order for me to be effective with folks that want to live a lifestyle that is not what I would pick for me.
Sure.
I had to get a lot of consultants to sort of learn what the healthy, well-regulated versions of that look like.
So is that the example where you were like, I don't agree with that lifestyle?
Not agree with. It's not comfortable for me. And I would never want to disclose anything like that detailed.
Right. Because that's confidentiality.
Right, but also, I've had folks with religious lifestyle.
Sure.
So remember, hyper-religiosity can be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also religious lifestyles, especially if you're practicing in places that have a lot of, like, that are a lot more religious, which I almost always have lived in and practice with people who are very likely, not just spiritual, but very religious. And so, like, I've learned how to find good coaches who have explained religions to me that I might not agree with, like that just my ideals and my sense of like what is healthy is not for me, is not what's right for everyone.
Right.
And so for sex positivity, but also for religion, those, I will say those are two areas, lifestyle areas that I've had to get a lot of external advice about, because they're usually highly specific and deeply important to the person that I'm working with.
Totally.
They can be practiced in deeply unhealthy ways.
I can't believe this conversation went like so fast. We're out of time, which is insane. Yeah, I know. But actually before we go, can you tell us what, if you suspect that a friend is borderline based upon their behavior, how do you help that person?
So first of all, I don't know that you should always take on helping people without their desire, but if you have somebody that you think is not getting well, like they're going to therapists or taking their medicine and they're not getting well, and you think it's really, really common for therapists to recognize someone has borderline personality disorder and never write it down as a diagnosis and never tell a patient.
Why? Why does that happen?
It's the number one disorder that most clinicians stigmatize. I remember my negative experiences.
Yeah. Yep.
And so it's reasonable to say, hey, listen, I know you're getting help, but the facts are you seem like you're really, really suffering and things don't seem like they're getting better. I kind of noticed this going on. What does your therapist say, or what have you thought about? And by the way, I don't know that that's going on for you. And I think you and I sort of have this joking conversation, which is like, listen, I'm going to bring something up.
Yep.
And if I'm wrong, we're going to pretend I never said anything. But if this is going on, I will totally help you advocate for getting it diagnosed in a non-stigmatizing way, mm-hmm. getting access to DBT and gold standard treatments for it, insisting that your therapist demonstrate treatment planning that shows results.
Right.
Or finding someone who is a better fit for you. And I'll help you do that.
Yeah.
Because I don't see you suffer, but maybe you feel fine. Maybe I just have it wrong. And you just like let them, and then it's up to them, right?
Yeah, you put it out there, and then it's their choice whether or not they're going to seek that help.
Because some folks never hear what borderline personality disorder is. You would not believe how many patients I've had in my office that it's all over their chart. Their therapist that's transferring to me is like, that person's like so borderline. And then I'm like, so you've been referred to me because you have borderline personality disorder for DBT. And they're like, I've never heard of that. And I just, I have to work to take a non-judgmental stance.
Right.
And say, not towards the person I'm seeing, but, and I have to say, I'm so sorry that you weren't told that that's really common. And folks don't know about, even though it's, everyone's heard of bipolar, but borderline personality disorder is actually way more common. And so then we just say good news. And by the way, unlike a bipolar disorder, which as you know, Sarah, you're going to be managing all of your life.
Yep.
Borderline personality disorder is something you can recover from. And isn't that wonderful? And so that's how I frame it. And it goes pretty well.
That's actually great. So then my question is that, what's an experience you've had with a patient where you've seen them fully recover, like without disclosing?
Oh, I've had that happen so many times.
Yeah.
Like that's the normal course of action for me.
Can you think about somebody without disclosing too much information where you saw them come in truly suffering and then they came out the other side and you were really like so pleased?
So I can tell you for several patients, a set of events, which is they usually come in, their personal life is chaotic, their relationships are painful, they are usually actively abusing substances, maybe engaging in frequent crises related to money and sex and a bunch of other things. And we have to address all sorts of therapy interfering behavior. They may, you know, there's a lot of mood dysregulation. They love me one session, they hate me the next, or they love me and hate me alternatively throughout a session, like when we first start. Mm. And we work the program together. And usually by about 6 months in, they've gone through one set of skills groups and they understand what getting well looks like, but they haven't got it mastered yet.
Mm-hmm.
And we start to do the second set of skills group and that's where they're reviewing it. So we've already learned everything once. And then the second time they're learning it, but they're learning it like it, that's when it clicks. And that's when they start to get relationships that they love,
mm.
friends that they keep, partners that they're happy with and not in constant crisis with. Their parenting, if they have kids, improves. The self-harm declines. They may be the first time that in a long time they don't feel like they want to kill themselves all the time. They get their money stable. They get their housing stable. For many of them, they want to be employed, but they've had all these chaotic behaviors, so keeping a job's been hard. So many of them find jobs. Like, I'm thinking of several situations where they find a job, and then we work on getting a better job, and then we work on getting a better job, and we work on getting a job with benefits, and. And then usually by the end of year one to year two, remember I told you we're setting that goal?
Yep.
My common experience is that the goal that we set, they met, which is, I'm financially finally stable. I own my own home. Patients who thought they'd never be in a good relationship are stably married to someone who's really awesome to them. Having relationships with their kids like they've never had before. able to start, some of them have, actually more than a couple of patients have started charities and run them and do good work. Some of them have become peer specialists. So they begin to work in mental health clinics with other folks. And I've seen this happen so many times that I've like changed my mind. It's a crime that we don't offer this recovery to more folks, because as intense as the suffering was, think how wonderful it is to have a life worth living after all that hard work. And that's what, so they come in and they're like, if I had known that at a year and a half later, my life could be like this, I would have done this a long time ago.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And you're doing such wonderful work. And I'm so impressed that we did not, I think maybe I cursed two times on this podcast, which is a miracle. And you didn't even drop an F-bomb, like nothing.
I was so excited. I didn't say fuck.
Oh, wait, you just said it. Okay. Awesome. Where can people find you on the internets?
So I love it if you follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doc Foreman, DocForeman. But also, like, totally, you can find me on Facebook, April, like the month, Foreman, like George. And I regularly moderate SPSM chat. You can find out more about that by following SPSM chat on Facebook, or I'm even making the hashtag sign. You can just follow hashtag SPSM on Twitter.
I thought that was like a West Coast, you know, like that was like a rap situation.
Like a gang sign, right?
Gang sign.
And also for folks who are interested in borderline personality disorder, they should totally check out on Sundays hashtag BPD chat run by my very good friend Carl Dunn Jr. And they should totally follow him on Twitter. We're good friends in real life and then on social media.
Does he have BPD?
No, he is a father of someone who does, and he has wonderful training with the National Education Alliance on Borderline Personality Disorder, and they're now celebrating their fifth year of uninterrupted weekly Twitter chats on BPD, and they're awesome. I love, every once in a while I'm a guest or I go visit, and I love these chats.
That's awesome. All right, thanks for hanging out with me. I'm going to stop this podcast, but don't hang up.
I will!
Okay, say bye to everybody.
Bye, everyone. Have a great week.